from the general session. We can call out here the fourth case, Benavides versus Farmer.
Please, the court, I'm Gary McQuain, I represent the plaintiff Joan Benucius, the appellant in this matter. We've raised three issues primarily on appeal, three central issues. The first is whether or not the plaintiff was entitled to judgment on what has been referred to by the parties as the May 5th vacancy. That was the only promotion opportunity that survived the various rulings of the trial court on summary judgment and in discovery matters. The plaintiff's position is that she was entitled to judgment because the defendant never met its burden of presenting evidence of a legitimate business reason for denying her that promotion. The two remaining issues relate to, first, promotions for which the plaintiff believes she was entitled to trial that were awarded prior to March of 91 and after July of 91. Two rulings by the trial court truncated the relief she sought to that four-month period, and our position on appeal is she was entitled to relief, discovery and relief for promotions both before and after that time period. Finally, there's a complaint regarding the defendant's or the plaintiff's access to discovery regarding complaints by other similarly situated employees of the defendant and computer statistics that underlie the defendant's affirmative action program. As to the May 5th vacancy, the trial court should have entered judgment for the plaintiff on that, for that position, either at summary judgment or on trial, because the defendant never presented any evidence that explained the reason why the plaintiff was rejected for that promotion. At summary judgment, the defendant offered no evidence whatsoever, and at trial, the defendant offered only the evidence of a Mr. Donnell, who could not testify as to the plaintiff's qualifications at any point in his or her career. He testified that he knew the successfully promoted employee, but had never met Ms. Benucius, knew nothing about her record, never saw her file, never compared her to the person who actually received that promotion.
Of course, that's different.
It is if the defendant at the summary judgment stage had met its burden of proof. I understand the position of the defendant is that the McDonnell-Douglas procedural structure falls away at trial, and that is the language in the cases cited, Hamner and Dietrich. However, in both of those cases, the defendant had actually met its burden of production at summary judgment, so it wasn't an issue. The courts did not address what happens when a defendant fails to meet its burden of production ever.
Legitimate business reason
for denying her the promotion.
There has to be some question about whether that's
pretext. If we got to that point, yes, Your Honor. Well, our complaint on summary judgment is that we were not granted summary judgment. Our complaint is that the defendant did not present any evidence of a legitimate business reason at summary judgment. And I understand the argument that we hadn't filed a separate motion, but the issues regarding all the McDonnell-Douglas issues were briefed in full by both parties. The only promotion for which the defendant did not offer a legitimate business reason at summary judgment was the May 5th violation, and that's because it had no such evidence. The only evidence... I do not believe it should. On the May 5th violation, I don't believe it should. Having gone to trial, however, even assuming our failure to file a motion rather than simply asking for it in our prayer for relief, summary judgment, precluded summary judgment for the plaintiff, at trial, when the defendant has never met the burden of production, that burden, the presumption that's created by a prima facie case, as the court found in summary judgment for the plaintiff, remains until it's rebutted by the defendant. I remind the court that McDonnell-Douglas was a case that was remanded not for pretrial proceedings, but for trial. Another case cited by the defendant, Burton versus Ohio Adult Parole Authority, was remanded for trial on the issues raised in McDonnell-Douglas. What happens once the defendant presents the evidence of a legitimate business reason, the presumption drops away. The procedural framework of McDonnell-Douglas, shifting burdens and the like, that falls away. The fact that those are the elements necessary to prove the claim does not fall away. When a defendant presents some evidence, however minimal, of a legitimate business reason, then the defendant is entitled to trial, no matter what. If he fails to present that evidence at any stage, it is our belief that the plaintiff is entitled to judgment as a matter of law. At some point, the defendant has to come forward with evidence of a legitimate business reason, or McDonnell-Douglas is meaningless. Well, in this case, it was, is not promoting the plaintiff. She, the burden of the defendant in this case was, and it's stated by the Supreme Court in U.S. Postal Service versus Aikens, you create the presumption, then the defendant has to show evidence why the plaintiff was rejected, not why the person who was successfully hired received the promotion. Presumably, every person promoted is qualified for the position. If a defendant had to prove that that person wasn't qualified, you would very rarely have a successful case for discrimination in employment. Our burden is to show there was discrimination by meeting prima facie case. They then have to show a business reason why she was denied. Only if we get to that stage does the plaintiff have to show pretext. We never got there. The defendant never put any evidence as to why the plaintiff or the party who was promoted was preferred over the plaintiff. There was no comparison at any point in the record of her record with the employee who was promoted.
Was that,
that was part of the reason, but certainly that employee's personnel file still must have existed. They could have, anyone from the agency could have reviewed her file and seen this is when she had this training, this is how long she'd been in that position. No one made any attempt to compare the two and say that this person was more qualified or even this is the reason this person should have been selected over the plaintiff. Well, I don't know that file existed or not. My understanding is that employee is still an active employee, although I don't know if that's clear from the record. Discovery was never produced in discovery, if you mean her file. We never saw any of the personnel files for any of the people related to the specific promotions that were originally at issue in this case. We got personnel files from hundreds of other employees, but never the ones that were relevant to this proceeding. If the court reverses the trial court's limitation of the plaintiff's claims, they could be quite substantial. As to complaints or promotions prior, I see I'm into my rebuttal time, as to promotions available prior to March of 91, that would obviously increase her damages for each period thereafter. If she was a GS-5 2 years earlier or a year earlier, each subsequent promotion, even at one grade level, would be higher. In the underlying administrative complaint itself, one of the positions she sought relief for was what's called a GS-579. In their brief, the defendant claims, well, you can only get promoted one grade per year. That's simply not true, and I think every supervisor employee at the agency knows that. There are positions that allow for two grade increases, and there were promotions during the period both before and after that set by the trial court that the plaintiff could have been entitled to, and that would have substantially increased her damages. We only have $300 here, but that's because of the rulings of the court. Of the rulings of the court truncating her relief. I'd like to reserve the remainder of my time if there's no further questions.
May it please the court. Good morning, Your Honors. I'm Jack Donatelli on behalf of the federal defendant. In terms of the last remaining vacancy that Mr. McGuane was talking about, that position didn't even become known until August of 2000, at the very end of discovery. And so what happened was, when plaintiff kept saying she didn't get all the discovery she wanted, that she wanted to know about more positions for which she might have been available, Judge Hart was very cognizant of her claims, and he listened to her, and he said, okay. So he ordered Social Security to do a hand search to see if there's some other that had missed the 26 that had been reviewed in the administrative proceeding. So we got a computer printout from 1991 to 1993, and we sat and looked at it and determined which of those promotions, those were the promotions that had occurred, which were promotions that she could have been eligible for. Then once it did that, so it had to look at some files to see what the job description was, compare them to what she could do. Then once we did that, we had to look and see which ones fit in the relevant time frame. Then once we did that, we had to see of the people who did get promotions, were they outside of plaintiff's protected group? So there was some work involved there. We finally came up with this one single vacancy that had not previously been considered that fit within the relevant time period. By this time, however, this was the last act of discovery. Judge Hart had ordered this. Now, Judge Hart had already granted 11 discovery close dates. 2 years. That's a lot in any type of case. So he was very aware of protecting plaintiff's rights. But he ordered us to disclose it. We did. Discovery was closed then at that time. Plaintiff then asked for her 12th date, and the Judge Hart finally denied it when he said, nothing you raise goes to that issue. In other words, he never requested the file that the specific file that he had been asking for here. In any event, I can say it would not have made a difference. The evidence that Judge Hart heard and what he found was that when a selecting official at Social Security was making his selection, he had the SF-171, the application that all employees submit, and made the selections from those. The SF-171 does not contain any information about age or race, and those are the only two remaining issues left in this case. And so Judge Hart concluded that plaintiff failed to show that any of the selecting officials could have, by under the system anyway, considered plaintiff's age or race. And so it wouldn't much matter if a plaintiff even had gotten the file of the person who got the promotion. Because it was discovered so late, it left the government in the bind. And that is, this particular vacancy had not been exhausted administratively, so there was no record that we could do back in 91 or 92 when this claim was first brought to determine why the selecting official for the May 5th vacancy did what he did. By the time it was discovered in August of 2000, the official was already deceased. So we came in and we produced evidence that he was deceased. There's been no showing that's pretextual. And we produced evidence showing from the person who had had the job right before him just months before the selection was made, Mr. Donnell. And he testified he knew the position, he knew the person selected, he knew what it needed. He knew that it needed a Spanish speaker and that the person selected was a Spanish speaker. And, of course, plaintiff in this case is not a Spanish speaker. So we proffered that as a legitimate business reason, although it's not the selecting official's reason, but it certainly is a legitimate business reason for doing what we did, and also to counter any inference that may arise in terms of the pretext analysis. That is, that we are not providing a reason, so we must be hiding discrimination. There is also now valid evidence in the record that there's an inference besides discrimination to draw, and that is that we wanted a Spanish speaker. And that's how that whole thing came about. In terms of the damages that were stipulated to a trial were $341.60. And mind you, this case involved, it's been 11 years now, it's two summary judgments and a trial. Plaintiff argued today that it could be substantially more. It actually couldn't be, and here's why. She had filed EEO claims in 88 and 89. In 90, she withdrew them all and because she had gotten a new supervisor and she wanted a clean start, she said. A year later, she goes back to the EEO counselor, and now she tries to re-erect the claims she had withdrawn back in 88 and 89. Only if those claims are resurrected can she get more than the damage amount that we're talking here. And what Judge Hart expressly found was that she can't show any covert action in, with regard to those other claims. In other words, she knew about it. In fact, her complaint even alleges that she did that. So there's no reason to use a continuing violation theory. So really, we're stuck at the $341.60, even if she prevails. If there are no other questions, we would just ask that please, Your Honors, put this litigation to an end after 11 and a half years. Thank you.
It is interesting to hear the government complain about the 11 and a half years of this litigation. The plaintiff filed one set of interrogatories in this case, submitted one set. The plaintiff submitted one set of document requests in this case. They were virtually identical to those submitted before the EEOC in 1992. We were trying to get the answers to those same requests and same document requests and interrogatories for the 8 and 9 years that this litigation has been pending in various forms. We finally, in August of 2000, found the one that may give her some damage before this court under the rulings of the trial court truncating the period for which she can seek damages. That one position was found by a computer search of a computer database that the defendant knew existed back in 1991. I took the deposition of Brad Boy. It's referenced in our motions to compel. He runs their computer system for the Baltimore office. He said he could have run a search of their personnel database. It would have taken him half a day to identify every position the plaintiff was qualified for within the area, the times, and the offices that were relevant. He gave that deposition in early 1999. They finally ran that search in 2000 and complained about the delays of this case. It is patently absurd. I'm almost out of time. I would ask the court, one issue we raised both at the trial court and in our briefs is the issue of the false affidavit where they tried to just kick this case out of court by claiming that all records have been destroyed. That affidavit by Yvonne Newsom, I believe, is what convinced Judge Hart that there was nothing here, that we were asking for them to produce records they could not. They didn't tell him about the computer database. They didn't tell him about the file cabinets that they had stored that Ms. Newsom personally maintained and knew about. At her deposition and at trial, she couldn't explain why she even signed the affidavit. That was a flatly false affidavit, and it was never addressed either by the defendant's counsel in evidence or in briefs, and was never addressed by the trial court. That shows the character of the defense of this case. Repeatedly, Your Honor, and motions to compel, motion for summary judgment, and a trial. I'm out of time for my answer. The trial court never addressed the issue. I appreciate the court's time.